Researching the history of racialization of Middle Eastern American communities from the 1900s until now. Sophia is a founding organizer of Swana Alliance and is a writer with the Haifan magazine. Sophia Armen and Nena Magboule, thanks for joining us. Why is that people from the Swana region are categorized as white? Nena Magboule, let's start with you.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor to speak with you. So to the point that you began with, which is how did we get to this place where folks from the Swana region who live in the United States are categorized as white? And the story begins over 100 years ago or so, when it was crucial that when immigrants to the United States were seeking naturalization, they had to be found in the eyes of the court to be quote-unquote white. Only white men were able to be naturalized, and that they would have the rights within that assignation. So to be able to own property, to be someone who could vote, to have the full rights as a citizen of the United States. And so it was imperative for immigrants, particularly racially liminal immigrants. In this case, as pertains to our conversation, this would very often be early Armenian immigrants to the United States, Arab immigrants. They would have to actually go to court oftentimes and to quote-unquote prove that they were white to a judge in order to have their naturalization applications be approved. And so you can go into the archives and see hundreds of transcripts of both the applicants themselves sitting in a courtroom testifying as to the different sorts of evidence that they had of their own whiteness. And these claimants would go on to represent, right, the whole group. So however a case came down on one particular applicant's identity then had ramifications for all members of that community. So you had expert testimony from people like anthropologist Franz Boas, who would offer arguments in favor of, in this example that I'm thinking of, the whiteness of Armenians. And so the stakes were incredibly high, that to be a fully pledged member of the body politic, you needed to be white at the time. And so we still live with the legacy of those citizenship laws today.
And when you say prove they're white, how would they do that?
When I say prove whiteness, I mean it in every possible aspect you could think of, like the variety of different forms of evidence that claimants would bring to court with them spanned everything from sort of debunked racial science that we would look at today and we would think is ludicrous, right? Things that have to do with like visceral physical expressions of a person's race, you know, like the size of their nose, the shape of their heads. That kind of evidence was surely leveraged in court. But even more interestingly, there was all different kinds of social evidence that these claimants and their supporters would bring to court. So again, in the case of Armenians, for example, the kind of social evidence would be something like saying, you know, we have a record of intermarrying outside of just our own Armenian community. And look, here are my examples of five people I know who are married to, for example, like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in my local neighborhood, so that we are intermarrying with incontrovertibly white people in our community must mean that we are white by association. Sometimes things like success in a local business community, so the sort of idea of socioeconomic advancement was also the kind of social evidence that they would marshal into being evidence of whiteness.
And the categories that we have, are they ethno-racial or racial?
These categories are very awkward. Like the census themselves will admit that the different kinds of categories and the way that they are organized, they don't map on at all to what we sort of commonly think of as ethnicity or race. And in fact, many people who work at the census now just talk about groups. They even avoid the terminology of ethnicity and race because at this point, these are just sort of lumped groups that coexist together in these different categories. And so even the census, right, has started to, in their press releases and in the way that they speak about the census, to start to do away with some of that language around ethnicity and race. Because as we all know, I think both from our personal experiences and as you start to read some scholarship about this area, you see that it's a very slippery slope, and disentangling these two terms from one another is very challenging, and oftentimes it doesn't actually even make much sense.
Sophia Armen?
Well, thank you so much again for having me on the program. I think everything that was just said was fabulous. Just to kind of add on to that, there's a wonderful quote by Cedric Robinson that for me has determined actually why I became an ethnic studies scholar, which is a scholar who studies race in America. the quote is, race is a myth, racism is reality. It's by Cedric Robinson, very, very famous black Marxist who actually pioneered the field of black studies in the U.S. in so many ways and coined the term racial capitalism. What he thought about is basically these categories of race are constructs socially, but they're ones that happen in process. So that's the ism, the racism. So in other words, there aren't certain attributes or anything genetic that race actually has to do with, right? It's the process of attributing power and oppression to different groups based on these really insignificant attributes and historically how that's looked. So I think the important kind of follow-up I'd like to say is, in terms of what does the census mean, it shows the type of social constructs or racial constructs that currently institutional power is manifesting, perpetuating, or invested in. And so we were just given a really great historical background on how this has changed, right, through history. If we talk about the earliest cases of SWANA Americans, so SWANA immigrants coming from the region, we know that actually the region itself looked very different at the time. So a wonderful scholar at USC named Sarah Gugliottieri has investigated, for example, the earliest Arab immigrants to the U.S., Syrian immigrants. But at the time, Syria actually meant, you know, what we would consider today Lebanon, Palestine, and many countries in the region. And so not only have racializations shifted, but also these borders have shifted. And the realities of what the kind of racial makeup of the U.S. has shifted. If we're talking about the first and earliest immigrants, I think it is important to note that through these court cases that were mentioned, for example, like one of the most historic of the SWANA communities is that first Armenian case, which went through various iterations, but the Cartosian case in the U.S. was very foundational, actually, to how Middle Eastern American immigrants after Cartosian would be racialized. And what's important to note about this is it had to happen because actually there were such a great amount of Armenians coming to the U.S., particularly around the genocide era. And so it was through the kind of everyday reckoning and problems of dealing with institutional issues of where do these folks fit that they would actually have to be put in these kind of cases. It's because there was, as you see, if you trace the immigration history, if you trace the years of how census data looks, it's really looking at also waves of immigration that are coming here largely in response to things like colonialism, imperialism, wars, or genocide. And so even something like the earliest court cases, I know the Armenian case, for example, the Armenian community in the U.S., which largely had just, most of, had just escaped persecution in what was then the Ottoman Empire or faced death, actually raised over $500,000 during that time to get one of the best legal systems in the country to fight for their naturalized whiteness. You know, $500,000 back then, in now's time, that's incredible to think about. It was basically like a grassroots effort transnationally to make it happen. So I know this on this end because actually I have family who came from some of the earliest waves of immigration from the pre-genocide and genocide era. And so I think what's important about this is to understand that all of these kind of actions that come from the community are really responses actually to racism through history, 100 years till now, dealing with institutional racism and having to use survival coping mechanisms, but also in this current racial kind of schema, in the way that, for example, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-blackness is used to pit these groups against each other. So I think what's important to realize is that these groups, whether they're Arabs, Iranians, Armenians, through time have had to deal with being in a country that often is actually doing much harm in their homelands, and then deal with the kind of climate that it exists to be immigrants in the U.S.
So how do the people from the SWANA region see themselves? Do they think of themselves as white? Neda, in your book you speak of, quote, an Aryan myth of cultural and racial superiority among Iranians. What is the origin of this, and why does it still prevail?
In the book that you're very generously referring to, which comes out on September 5th, it's called The Limits of Whiteness, Iranian Americans and the Everyday Politics of Race, I overall argue that Iranians, like others from the Swana region who live in the United States, are amidst a racial paradox. I say that they're counted as white by the federal government, but they sometimes possess everyday experiences that are closer to those of communities of color. And so in my book, I'm offering a century's worth of historical and legal evidence that show how Iranians specifically have been pushed and pulled across a white, non-white color line. And so the piece that you've referred to, which again, I can only speak specifically to the Iranian case, is that when you're looking at immigrant generations within Iranian America, it's very much the case that back in Iran, when they were children, those who would go on to be the first generation of Iranian immigrants to the U.S., either right around, you know, the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, or even those who were here in the 1950s and 60s, so this would be a generation like my own parents, they were pretty much indoctrinated into a nationalist myth. It was through mass schooling and history books about what was termed a kind of divine superiority of Iranians and their quote-unquote Aryan origins. This was an effort that was propagated by nationalist intellectuals, those associated with the reign of the Pahlavis, the monarchy there in Iran, and so the kind of mythology that they were very much interested in developing and circulating was also, interestingly enough, dovetailing at that time with eugenicist racist science that was exported out of Europe and North America. And it got to where when you sort of knit this more homegrown kind of Aryan myth in Iran with the stuff that was circulating from the global north, Iranians have come to sense a strongly felt sense of whiteness. And what's fascinating in the case of these immigrant generations is what happens when you have a deeply held racial ID that you bring with you to the United States as an Iranian immigrant. However problematic, scientifically bunk or racist as that was, even back in Iran, what happens when that racial ID of white is basically illegible or lost in translation in your everyday interactions on the ground with Americans in your new country? And so that core paradox is what animates my book.
Sophia Armen, what would you like to add?
And what's important to understand, especially for listeners who are not familiar with the Swana region or the Middle East, is that the Middle East itself is actually quite a multi-ethnic and multi-religious space. And so a lot of these conversations that we're having about Iranians and Arabs, you have to ask kind of who you're talking about. Many of these societies are multi-ethnic societies. There are Armenians who are Iranian. There are Kurds who are in Iran. There are Yazidis. We are, unlike Orientalist myth and propaganda, actually quite diverse populations. And so it's interesting because just like what was just said about kind of the loss in translation that happens between the kind of racial schema in the region and then the racial supremacy or hierarchy in the U.S., is that also doesn't translate.
Neda Maghboule, in your book you use the term liminal whites. We from the Swana region don't fit in a racial category.
You know, I think something that's really interesting is we are at a critical turning point right now where the Census Bureau is considering the inclusion of a new MENA category, Middle East and North African, in the 2020 census. And so it's interesting because these aren't just hypothetical conversations that the Census Bureau has, but these are actually tests that they run in between every 10-year census, where they make actually like evidence-based recommendations to change the categories or keep them together. And so the Census Bureau at this point in 2017 has released some of their findings from these different pretests that they run in between the censuses. And so the most recent evidence that they have shows that among these liminal whites that we're talking about, right, members of the Swana community, when these groups are offered the choice, they overwhelmingly choose to self-identify as MENA over white on a census form. And this is true across all of the subgroups that Sophia so brilliantly articulated. Our region, historically, the borders are constantly changing. Ethnicity has overlapped across these different national borders. You know, we have multiracial people in all of these countries, but nonetheless, across all of the different subgroups, the Census Bureau in its own testing has shown that when MENA groups are offered the choice, they overwhelmingly choose to self-identify as MENA over white. And so, although I talk about how when you put it all together between the social experiences of discrimination and marginalization and disempowerment, plus the sorts of relative privileges that some members of the sauna community do have, and when you put it all together and you come down to something like the census, it does seem that this is a community that by 2020 is cohering around some sort of pan group category that is separate than white.
Sophia Armand.
People's experience definitely affect how they view their own racial identity, which is something important, especially the media and how institutionally they experience power in the U.S. But I think what was so brilliantly also articulated, right, is that this MENA checkbox is a really interesting moment for all of us because we have this kind of opportunity to institutionally be recognized. But just as, for example, the Armenian community could say as well, what happens when you kind of put out a campaign for recognition is also that means you're often doing it on the terms of the institution itself. So I think there's so many pros and incredible important opportunities for the MENA Checkbox campaign, including just the coalitionary interfaith and inter-ethnic community organizing that's happening on the ground between Arab groups, Iranian groups, North African groups that are really thinking about these kind of tough questions and actually coming together around them. Because surprisingly, a lot of these NGOs, social justice organizations, even youth organizing has been largely segregated in silos based on, you know, either working from a Muslim lens or working from a ethnic specific lens. And so that's a really important opportunity. And as the data does show, people are more likely to check the box when they see them on it. And they do identify. What's the interesting part, though, of course, again, you know, in the construction of MENA, for example, we see that in contrast to, for example, the title of this show, which is SWANA, right? So MENA is actually taking the kind of conception of this region as the Middle East, which is a very Eurocentric still term that thinks about this entire region in relation to the West and has the kind of Orientalist colonialist history in its origins. And so I think it's always interesting when grassroots campaigns particularly are reflected in institutional power, and it's important to see these moments as victories, but it's also important to think about why they are happening. And a lot of concerns have come up in the community around, for example, what would it mean to take census data on MENA Americans, for example, particularly in an era of heightened surveillance, really U.S. government wrongdoing. In the last couple decades around particularly SWANA Americans. And so I think, you know, these are important, incredible questions, and they are something that are complicated and should be more complicated as we speak about them, because there are important material realities for how people experience race and racism, you know, in our country on the ground every day.
Yeah, if I can just jump in really quick to elaborate on this really important point, which is that, you know, it's recognition on the census is not going to save us. In some ways, people are really right to bring up a concern that this is going to make profiling that much easier, that there's going to create a kind of registry that the government would very easily be able to reference or go to. But what's interesting is that even as SWANA communities have been classified as white, like now, it hasn't stopped the government from summarily profiling SWANA folks. It was revealed about 10 years ago that the Census Bureau was using cities and zip codes associated with the last names of people that it surmised were from the SWANA region. This is in the wake of 9/11. They were sharing these lists, including city and zip code of SWANA Americans, with the Department of Homeland Security. When they were confronted about this, Homeland Security said that they needed this data from the census to determine which American airports needed better signage in Arabic. But this remains an excuse that I think many people are not buying. And so this was while SWANA folks have been subsumed, hidden, quote-unquote, in the white category. And so I think if the government wants to be able to surveil this community, we already have plenty of evidence that shows that this has been happening. But the community hasn't been able to reap any of the benefits that they would receive from being properly counted.
So I think, you know, what's important is to note that the MENA Checkbox campaign has really actually come from the grassroots. It's come from the community, which is different than how other communities have appeared on the census. So one, there's been long-standing precedents to try and seek a distinguished box. This is not a recent fight. Organizations like the Arab American Institute, several Armenian organizations, Iranian organizations, have actually been trying to gather census data for quite a long time. I mean, we're talking over 5 decades. And oftentimes that's actually looked like people rallying community to check the other box and write in an ethnicity, or to actually answer, there's a separate question currently as the census stands that is like an ethnic question before you get to these other categories. And so some of the reasons why people are advocating for this box is because I'll say like 4 things. Number one, accuracy and data are some of the most important tools that you can have in the United States. And that means in terms of lobbying power, political power, but also access to things we might not even think of. For example, in the Armenian case, when we need to go into a bone marrow registry folks matches, we actually have to go to the database of the Republic of Armenia to find people to match medically. If I'm talking from a scholarly standpoint, it is through digging, and I'm sure my co-panelists can talk about this, it is through digging and digging that we have to find even basic numbers about, you know, demographics of this country, numbers of Swanav Americans in different cities. There is not the kind of incredible work that a census, a federal level census would do, which is the best that you could get. And that scholarship that can be produced out of that means so much for the political power, for the representational power of our communities, and it also means that we can write on ourselves for ourselves. There's also, in terms of advocacy, because the federal government also does really important kind of federal grant programs. It goes down to everything through the court system, federal forms. It is important for folks being able to actually actively and accurately identify discrimination in the workplace through legal means, for example. In terms of advocacy, it is statistically proven how communities who are represented in data actually have the ability to use that data for advocating for different political causes. And currently, in our current times, that would mean quite a bit. Same as with jobs and access. It has the ability for young folks like me, for example, who are involved in kind of social justice and representation and inclusivity in the workplace or in universities, to advocate for who is actually at the top. I'll give you an example. I was part of the SWANA checkbox campaign at the University of California, and this was the first ever institutional at this level checkbox campaign to identify SWANA Americans at a university. And it was through a lot of grassroots organizing of young students over years of work that actually pushed the University of California to have these checkboxes. And it just meant about actually knowing who we are and where we're coming from. And once we found this data, which has now been collected for only a couple years, we can also see then how proportionally we're not getting into the University of California compared to what we should be, what our population is in California. So in other words, this is important because we have to know who we are to advocate for who we are. We have to know where we are to organize each other. And it's extremely powerful data and knowledge in actually bringing together and bringing about change.
Unfortunately, we are running out of time. There's so much more to discuss, so I'd like to invite both of you to come back and continue this conversation. Sophia, how could people get involved in that campaign? And any last thoughts about what's been going on in the country over this weekend?
Thank you so much again for having us on here. It was really, honestly, I'm in great company. I have to say, particularly right now, as SWANA Americans, there is absolutely no place for standing on the sidelines. As we're seeing the kind of rise in white supremacy in its most virulent and vile face, it's important for us to understand our histories and also to stand up with other communities of color throughout the United States. The most important way that people can get involved is actually to either join a racial justice organization within their own city or to start one. I'm the co-founder of SWANA Alliance, which is a young, youth, women-led, queer-led SWANA organization that now is popping up all over the United States, that is young people deciding that we are going to actively work against white supremacy, Islamophobia, queerphobia, and sexism in our own communities, but also work with other communities to make this the reality that we live in. And so if people want to get involved with those efforts, we just ask you to follow us. We're on Facebook at Swana Alliance, and we are posting as well about these MENA campaigns. So particularly if you're interested in working on the MENA checkbox, there are several organizations that are working on this: NIAC, the Arab American Institute, the Arab American National Network, and several of the Armenian organizations as well. So please follow up with us at Swan Alliance. We'd be happy to get you involved.
Nela Marboule, final thoughts?
I think there's a place right now for Swana folks to find a locus of organization, whether it's their, you know, sort of specific ethnic community, a sort of diasporic group to which they feel a sort of kinship and an affinity. It's important to do work there, but it's absolutely crucial for these connections to be made across these lines as well. And so in the same way that I would encourage, for example, any Iranians who are not involved in a group like IAB, Iranian Alliances Across Borders, or Afghans who are not yet involved in ADEP, Afghan Diaspora for Equality and Progress, to seek those organizations out. These are progressive, youth-led, incredible racial justice organizations that are grassroots efforts from within those two communities in particular. I think it's important to reach out to them, but to also, through perhaps these organizations, or like Sophia saying, in our local communities, connect to Black Lives Matter. You have to connect with organizations that are supporting undocumented immigrants. These are times right now where the stakes are, could not be higher, and so we need to find strength within our communities, but we also need to be finding alliances as well.
Mina Marboule and Sophie Armen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Nela Marboule is a professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Toronto. She's the author of The Limits of Whiteness, Iranian Americans and the Everyday Politics of Race. Sophia Armen is a PhD student in Ethnic Studies at the University of California, San Diego. She's researching the history of racialization of Middle Eastern American communities from the 1900s until now. Thanks to my guests, especially thanks to Sebo Oshagan. This show is archived on kpfk.org. On behalf of the Swana Region Radio, I am Ankine Agassian.
All hands on deck! We're launching KPFK's Everybody Wins with Solar campaign. With the imminent threat of climate change and the absolute lack of leadership from Trump, the station is bringing solutions to the grassroots. As a homeowner, if you'll take just a few minutes to take a picture of your power bill and a brief phone call to see how much money you can save with the sun, a $100 donation will be generated for the station, whether you go solar or not. If you do decide to switch to renewables and get away from fossil fuels, the station will get another $500 to help shorten the next fund drive. Not a homeowner? Don't worry, you can help too. Just log into kpfksolar.org and follow the simple prompts. Together we can all help save the planet while supporting KPFK. Just go to kpfksolar.org.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles of the Pacifica Radio Network is currently seeking a permanent general manager to provide leadership and vision. Someone who is serious about innovative, high-quality, community-based programming. Qualified applicants can go to kpfk.org for more information.
Hi, this is Charlie Robinson at KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara. Power to the people.